Bonjour, bonsoir, and bienvenue au Histoire pour vous. You probably didn't realise how good I was at French, did you? Well, it's one of the many things I can do. Hello, everyone. I am Douglas Rattle.
I'm Hugh Kennard. Hello there.
Hello, Hugh. Bonjour, or should I say bonsoir? No, it's bon... When are we? What time is it?
Well, it depends when they're listening, doesn't it? Right, so what are we doing this week?
We are putting on our finest attire and sauntering down the promenade towards the leafy, manicured gardens of the Palace of Versailles in France.
That's right, that's right. So we'll be talking about Le Grand Siècle, which actually means the Great Century and not the big bicycle, which it sounds like.
Now, why, what is the grand, for the benefit of our listeners, what is the grand century? What, which period in history are we talking here, Hugh?
We're talking about 1600s, really. And it's called the Great Century because people got to dress up and be snobby with each other. And there was an awful lot of money for the rich, mainly because the French did their own sort of little version of the Reformation. And they threw out all the Huguenots or all the Protestants. So they had loads of money, well, loads of somebody else's money that they could play with. And that's exactly what they did.
You know, it's funny when you talk about these sort of fancy, I suppose it's a garden party. It reminds me of the last summer's Conservative Party barbecue in Worplesdon that I went to. Do we have time for this? It's very funny.
Well, I've heard it 8 or 9 times, but
I think it keeps getting funnier, and our listeners haven't heard it. So I was talking to Shelley McCormack, you know, who runs the Honda Garage, and he was quite drunk, and it was very funny. And I made some comment about how I think that, you know, Japanese cars are very efficient, even if they don't look very nice. And because poor old Shelley had had too much Cinzano, he threw up all over the dog. And this is the funny bit.
What's the name of the dog?
I don't know. I don't know, actually. He might not have had one. They tend to just label their dogs by a year of birth. Anyway, so the dog was covered in sick and it ran off into the house. Shelley was very, very appalled. And I said to him, without missing a beat, I said, well, there's your Honda review right there.
Did he laugh?
Well, he stifled a laugh, but it was more of a choke, really. And I couldn't really tell because he ran off into the house too. And I was left standing there, you know, in a damp patch on the lawn. But the point is, I would imagine that that display of decadence, you know, and bacchanalian fun was nothing compared to what happened in Versailles. Am I right?
Oh, God, yeah. So, born in 1638, Louis XIV ascended to the throne at 4 years old.
Do you reckon he was given a little stool to climb up on that when he ascended the throne, because if he was only four?
Maybe he had some sort of high throne, like a high chair, with like some sort of strappage to stop him from tumbling out.
Or one of those sort of 180 degree flip tables. You know, that you flip over the top and back down. It secures the child in place.
I don't think that's a thing. That sounds like gymnastics, isn't it?
No, the child doesn't flip over. The table flips over.
It flips. You don't want a table. Well, you'll spill your dinner, aren't you?
No, but you're not listening. You lift it up and the child is unleashed. And you put the child back in the high chair and then you flip the table over, securing the child and presenting the child with a tray, much like you would get on an aeroplane.
Don't think you should secure children with tables. That sounds desperately dangerous. I don't think the twins would stand for that. If I just put a table on them, stop them moving.
Well, they're far too old. This is for children very small, like Louis the 14th.
Ah, speaking of Louis the 14th, he was brought up by his mum, Queen Anne of Austria, who was also known as Infanta of Spain, Queen of France, wife of Louis XIII, mother of Louis XIV, commander of the armies of the North, general of the Felix Legions, loyal servant to the true emperor Marcus Aurelius, husband to a murdered wife, and father of Luke Skywalker, the last Jedi. Now, his mother couldn't give him everything because she's only a mother after all. And so his godfather and the First Minister, Cardinal Margarine, gave the young king political training. So political training it means like holding babies, which is quite difficult for a four-year-old, lying, hiding money, shirking work, giving contracts to friends from school or nursery in this case, and claiming expenses for watching pornography in hotel rooms. When he was 10, now Louis the Sun King, Louis the God-given, which is what people called him because they didn't really have the hang of insults, well, he became the victim of a civil conflict known as the Fronde.
The what? Sorry?
The Fronde. Not the Fons, the Fronde. Do you want me to spell it for you?
Yes, please.
F-R-O-N-D-E, silent E, unless it's Fronde.
But I don't know, if it's not got an acute accent on, then it's silent, it's Fronde.
I don't know how to do an acute accent on my keyboard, so it may have an acute accent.
I learnt this the other day. You hold down the E, and then a whole selection pops up.
So in the Fronde, the Parliament of Paris and the aristocracy started bullying and picking on Louis because he was only small after all. And so he fled Paris completely, ran away, basically. And then in 1661, Margarine died. So Louis thought, I'll just be king now. And he was aged 23, thought, I can stand up to these buggers. So the first thing he did was throw out the Huguenots, we discussed, who crossed the channel to Britain in dinghies and the backs of doors to settle in Wandsworth, Shoreditch, and eventually Rwanda, I think. He also fought a few wars under Louis XIV, and so he started to get a little bit of respect. He had a little bit of money. He was quite a hard lad, you know. And so he fought like the Franco-Dutch War, the Nine Years' War, the War of the Spanish Succession, the War of Devolution, the War of Titillation, the War of the Reunions, the War against the Bunyans, and ELO's War of the Worlds.
Now, the Nine-Year Wars, that's the one that interests me. Mm. How long did that last?
That was just under a decade, I think.
Right, okay, fine.
Then Louis XIV married his cousin on both sides at Saint-Jean-de-Luz. So he could use her apartment in Benidorm with that nice green and white striped awning on the balcony and a very small shared pool. I think they had to share it with some Germans, probably. And the royal couple had six children. Although Louis did have 246 mistresses, including some official ones who were fully certified and MOT'd.
He was a collector then, wasn't he, really? A collector of women.
A hoarder of whores.
Now, Hugh, you know, we're not allowed to use that word anymore. It's not acceptable, you know. And someone wrote in, you know, and we have to say...
Keeper of sluts.
No. We have to use more delicate words for the time. I mean...
A kidnapper of slags.
No, you see, this is going in the other direction from where we want to be. We're never going to beat the algorithm if we're going to start using this kind of language, OK? We talked about this in the pub. You have to say something euphemistic like a lantern holder or mysterious woman or shh, it'll cost you 50 bob. You know, those kind of phrases. Yeah, and then we know what we're talking about is prosies.
Oh, when you said algorithm, I thought you were talking about some form of dance music and you were just listing songs you liked because it was quite loud that day. I mean, and I could see Tanhelm just standing at the bar talking and he just always draws my gaze. The man always draws my gaze.
Hugh, Tanhelm is not a part of your life, okay? As much as you want him to be, just so you can put the hate somewhere. You need to forget him. Move on. Anyway, I interrupted. Go for it.
In 1682, Louis moved the whole royal court to the Palace of Versailles so he could keep an eye on those bullies who'd nicked his tuck-shop money and given him wedgies during the Fronde. Now, at the time, Versailles was just a tiny little village of 300 people or so, and really it was just a hunting lodge for Louis XIII. So 3,000 to 10,000 people basically moved there. And they had very strict rules on who could speak to whom, when and how, and using what body language, don't you see? Mm. Now, the favoured were put up in the palace itself, with the less popular situated further out in Versailles. Now, a garden view was favoured. Some people had a view of the bins or the staff car park, and that affected the Airbnb rating something horrid. Now, people were desperate for the king's attention, because he gave his favourites gold snuff boxes on New Year's Day and like wigs made from aardvark eyelashes and plaster casts and monkey bums and stuff like that. But to get his attention, there were very strict rules, you see.
Okay, so he put in a... This is fascinating. I mean, what an idiot.
Oh, I don't know. I think they're like manners for sort of the inbred, you know, and other aristos.
Well, actually, we probably could have benefited from a few rules at the Warbleston Conservative Barbecue, you know? I think if someone had, you know, put up a sign saying you're not allowed to take the last sausage straight from the grill, children must be kept in the car with the window cracked.
To be honest, I wouldn't be surprised if Louis XIV encouraged people to be sick on dogs. Sort of thing I think he probably would have enjoyed.
Well, that's exactly it, isn't it? Which is why I thought my anecdote was actually rather relevant to this particular episode, you know. I didn't just say it because I like the sound of my own voice.
Let's not bring it up again.
Okay.
So, some of the rules, okay? You have to bow or curtsy to the royal family. And if they're not there, you have to bow or curtsy to paintings of them.
Well, that would take forever. Heaven's sake, there's so many, you wouldn't get past the hallway.
Well, precisely. And imagine the knee complaints. Imagine. I mean, if I kneel down to pick up Lego or something, I'm not getting up for like 20 minutes, I find.
No. Well, so imagine having to navigate through that, you know, whilst wearing, well, we'll get onto that later, but I mean, wearing the clothing of the time, it's not easy to get up and get down, you know.
It's not easy to get up and get down in just a pair of jeans, I found. I dropped the remote control the other day. I had to watch something with Alan Carr in it for 20 minutes before somebody else came in to pick it up for me.
You need to get the app. You know, you need to get the app so you put the remote control on your phone. That's what I've done.
I don't need a remote control for the phone. Why would I need a remote control for my phone?
No.
What am I going to do? Get it to ring someone and then just shout from the other side of the room?
Anyway, carry on.
If you run into someone of superior rank... and they actually say hello to you, which they don't have to, you must start the conversation, not them, although they started it by saying hello. And they have to respond, otherwise it's rude. But they can just answer with a small nod, a little tweak of the nipple, or a loud raspberry to the face.
Oh, I see. So you go, hold on, so you go, hello, and you go, is that
yeah,
it?
Well, yeah, basically. Oh, I mean, that sounds quite good fun to me.
Yeah, I'm on board.
Women don't have to reply to men.
Oh.
They do have to reply to women.
Well, that makes sense. It's a similar frequency, isn't it?
Not exactly. But even if they just say like, oh, get her, or shut your face. However, at a party, you can say hello to someone of superior rank, but they can ignore you or kick you in the nuts or just mess your hair up if they want to.
See, again, it's just like that barbecue.
Now, if you don't know the rank, address them as Madame, Monsieur, or Mademoiselle. Or, hello, Mister, hello, Mrs., or hello, Ms. See?
Is it Miss or Ms? I never understand the difference. What's the difference between saying Miss or dropping the I? I don't...
That's the spelling, isn't it?
Oh, yes.
Never show the King or Queen, or a painting of them, your back. Which is pretty difficult. It means you have to walk backwards if they're facing you, and you probably have to weep and apologise for your very existence as you do it. But I think if there's a painting behind you, I'd suppose you'd have to walk like a crab.
Well, absolutely. I was about to say, if you're walking down one of those long, long, thin sort of, you know, corridors that palaces have many of, and there's a picture on both sides, what do you do? How do you go along?
Pirouette, I suppose, wouldn't you?
Oh, who has the time for that?
Now, if you're passed food from a serving dish the king has been served from, you have to bow or curtsy to the dish. See? Now, if you see a McDonald's or an Uber Eats delivery for the king, salute it. And if you smell a burp that may have a royal flavour, wave at it until your wrist really aches.
Oh, no, I kind of like that one, I think. That's quite good, yes.
I like that. I mean, it's the only time which someone's really going to nod at my rice pudding, or at least even acknowledge it.
Yeah, but you it's too watery, Hugh. You remember the twins' birthday, and you made so much of this stuff, and they got confused. They thought it was milk that had gone off.
Well, skimmed milk's much better for you and gives you bright eyes like a bunny rabbit.
There were a lot of hungry bunny rabbits at that party. I don't mind telling you, they wouldn't go near the stuff.
They should have eaten it then, shouldn't they? Now, if someone enters a room when you're seated, immediately stand up, kick over your chair, set light to it, explaining that the chair tiptoed up beneath your buttocks and snuck in without you noticing.
Oh, I like that.
Don't knock at doors. Scratch on them like a dog needing to be let out to do a toilet.
Or a priest.
Yeah. Some of the people actually grew their nails particularly long, so their scratching was louder.
Well, that makes sense.
I don't think you'd wear gloves then, probably, but I wouldn't know. Right, then there's... Now, this one's very complicated. It had me a little confused, okay? So, always compliment people in conversation.
Yes.
But never compliment them with the same compliment.
Well, that makes sense. I mean, if I would say, you look nice, they'd think I was mad.
Well, what about if you said it to somebody else?
Oh, so hang on. So, well, presumably, I mean, you could just say it to different people.
Oh, I like your green eyes. Oh, I like your green eyes. I got blue eyes!
Well, no, but that's why you... It's a safeguard against sounding like a complete idiot, because, of course, you would say, I like your green eyes, and you turn to the one with the blue eyes, and go, I like your blue eyes, and then your compliments are fine. They're well-received, and they're understood.
Seem as shallow as my rice pudding.
Well, I just think it's quite nice. If I'm in a social situation, I go, you've got a nice bum, and then I say, you don't, but you have a nice smile, then I think that would work very well. I think I've got myself out of a pretty awkward hole.
You've never commented on my bum.
Well, I don't need to.
Oh. Now, don't compliment people on their clothes, because it might be taken wrong. And don't compliment them on their family, because they might not like their family.
Well, that's... I can understand that.
And don't be witty when complimenting, because sarcasm wasn't really invented until American stand-up comedy, and so people didn't really understand wit then. When I talked about complimenting on clothes...
Yes.
I mean, there was quite a broad mixture of clothes then, but I don't really know that much about it, except for the size of dresses and the size of hair, which is all that I really notice when I go out anyway.
Well, I mean, this is the thing. I mean, I can pick up the slack because, you know, as you know, I know a lot about clothing because I briefly did an internship on Savile Row when I was a student. I don't know if you remember.
Is that when you started wearing, like, salmon socks with your mustard cords?
Absolutely, yes. And a lot of people said they weren't complimentary colours. And I said, oh, no, this is bold and edgy, you know. They were right. It didn't look good. But I was being bold.
It's quite an interesting thing to shout from a passing van, isn't it? Those aren't complimentary colours. I remember that.
Most building merchants just would go, oh, like your bum, don't like your eyes. But, you know, to compliment me on my lack of complimentary colours, ironically, I was actually impressed. I thought that was, well, at least the quality of labourer has gone up in the world, it would appear.
Perhaps they've been some sort of scholar of Versailles.
Well, if they are, then they're probably listening. So, as you said, the French nobility at Versailles, they adhered to a very elaborate and opulent style of dress, which reflected, you know, both the grandeur and the formal elegance of the Baroque period. For the benefit of our listeners, the Baroque period is when people would go to a bar and listen to rock music. You know, so in many ways it hasn't changed. I mean, I can break it down that the men had particular attire, the women had particular attire. I'll go through the men first, shall I? Because that's just how it tends to be. They would be wearing a justaucorps.
Pardon?
Justaucorps.
Do you need to go?
No. It's French, Hugh, for coat. Just a body. Is often made of luxurious fabrics like silk, velvet, you know, or Velcro. You know, it featured tight sleeves with decorative cuffs and was adorned with embroidery and, of course, buttons. Now, the buttons could be made of wood, gold, silver, ivory, or, in some very extreme cases, chocolate. And the man responsible for this trend was the Marquis de Cabrais. And he would be absolute the talk of the town in the winter months, but in the summer when it got too hot and the chocolate buttons melted, it just looked like he'd fouled himself on his sleeves. But you know, the cuffs could be as decorative as possible, though. You could have them made of lace, Egyptian cotton, wool, ice, and brass. Solid silver was the ultimate sign of opulence, but this, of course, as you know from your science lessons at school, Hugh, is very problematic during thunderstorms because silver is the metal that has the most conductivity. And it wasn't unusual for nobles to be struck by lightning. The charge carried through the wrists, and they would shoot bolts of deadly energy at the nearby swans. It was fantastic to see, but absolutely horrific for the poor birds.
I'd never pity a swan. Ghastly birds. They're like the pit bulls of the bird world, aren't they?
They're absolute savages, and you know that they could break your arm. But I know they could do so much more.
And they look so hoity-toity.
You don't see a chaffinch, you know, swanning around the park, you know.
Yeah, it could hardly damage your earlobe, though, could it, a chaffinch?
Unless it flew into it really quickly, Hugh, and that did happen once to my neighbour. Under the juste corps was a vest, not the string kind that you know, your father used to wear when he lost his mind and started wandering into the street. And the vest was worn under the coat, again, highly decorative and usually shorter than the coat, to showcase the fine fabrics and embellishments, because if they were longer than the coat, it wouldn't be a vest, but it would be a dress. The fabrics are most commonly included silk, but if you really wanted to impress the king, Hugh, you had a vest fashioned from the skin of silkworms. So you sort of skipped out the silk and you just got the worms. And so what would often happen is the really wealthy noble folk in France would catch a whole load of silkworms, put them in a bucket, kill them, and then compress them in a mesh flattening device called an embouteillage. And then they were stretched out and wrapped up, and you just paraded around Versailles looking like you've got some horrible skin disease. But they knew it was silkworm, and they loved them for it.
Chilling.
Then there were breeches, knee-length pants.
Come on, we don't use those words, do we? We were talking about that earlier.
Oh, yeah, sorry. The knee-length pants. Pantaloons, I suppose we can call them. Oh, although we can't say loon, can we? Oh, it's such a minefield.
Panta-mental health well-being?
Panta-mental health well-being. So, mm-hmm. Panta-mental health well-being, pants, for short. Mm. They were commonly worn and typically matched the fabric of the juste corps.
Can you say commonly?
Oh, you can. That's fine. They're not even listening. They don't even have an account.
Of course you're right.
Anyway, they were typically, though, they were covered in fabric to match the juste corps, but they were typically made of lead. And it's where we get that famous phrase, "Look out, there's a French lead bastard," which Wellington would cry before cantering into the fray. Stockings and heels, of course. Stockings with shoes with red heels. Red heels was a trend started by Louis XIV himself. They were very fashionable, and these red heels indicated nobility. Glass heels indicated a willingness to gyrate around an ornate pole, which is what they would often do when they'd had a few clarets. Wigs. Now, you mentioned
the wig. Hang on a minute. Wasn't there also like well-heeled, where there was a well at the bottom containing water on your shoe?
No. That's somewhere on television. There's a klaxon going because that's actually a myth that's been perpetuated for many years. The well-heeled phrase, nothing to do with wells at all.
Oh,
it comes from the original phrase a welt heel, which is basically if you had a disgusting skin infection that went right down to the backs of your legs. So if you were well-heeled, and often the nobility had disgusting skin infection due to the amount of, coitus that they engaged in, you see.
Oh, is that a type of seafood?
It could be, depending on where you go down. So the wigs, they were large, curled, of course, powdered, white. Again, status symbol and essential to the noble ensemble. The bigger the better. Some would be 6 or 7 foot high and held up by some poor people hidden inside.
Hidden inside what?
In the wig. They would often, it wasn't unusual for the very rich French noble to have one or two commoners inside the wig, which was basically put atop a sort of wicker frame. And they were inside keeping the whole thing up with their hands. And it was very good to see, because apparently, according to the writings of Voltaire, The wig would move around, like when you see those rather novelty cactuses that you buy at petrol stations. You put battery in and you play a bit of music and they dance to it.
Oh, how charming.
Yeah, very charming. Yeah. One man, Le Comte d'Avocado, he entered the gardens of Versailles with a wig that was half a mile in height, and he was immediately crushed to death. Now, women. Gowns were elaborate, as you'd expect, with very wide skirts. The fabric choices were similar to men's, silk, velvet, silkworm, earthworm, and PVC. Corset, tightly laced.
Did they do it up with tapeworm?
Probably. A tightly laced corset, of course, was worn to define the waist and support the bust. For especially some of the women, you know, they needed a bit of support up top, you know, to create what, you know, we all know and love, the pronounced hourglass figure. Corsets, of course, were whalebone, chimp bone, and human bone, which was a horrible sight, but apparently the really rich people loved it. Now, also to achieve the fashionable wide-hipped look, women wore panniers under their skirts. These are hoops, basically. You know, a big hoops, you know, and often they'd slip down and they'd have to sort of, you know, get them all up again by shimmying their hips and legs. And that's where hula hoop contests came from. Décolletage. Now we're getting a little fruity, Hugh, so strap yourself in. These gowns often had a low leg line, which accentuated with lace or embroidered trim. But people weren't looking at the lace or the embroidered trim. No, they were looking at, you know, the front monkeys, weren't they? You know, they were looking.
Hang on,
at the...
wait a minute. What's décolletage? I thought that was when you left college.
That's what it's known as now, but originally it was referring to knockers.
Oh.
And then, of course, hair. Oh my word! I mean, they were high and elaborate, and they incorporated elements like curls, feathers, jewels, bats, tables, guinea fowl, horse chestnuts. Catamarans, you name it. I mean, they were all in there. But basically, whatever you could shove in your barnet, the more fancy you were. Accessories, well, I mean, take your pick, Hugh. They were lavish. Necklaces, earrings, bracelets, coffee tables. I mean, it, whatever you could think of. Again, there was one instance where Madame Comte de Millionnaire arrived at one party draping an entire kitchen unit from IKEA behind her. Yeah, and as we've realised, you know, they would embellish things hugely, you know. It wasn't unusual for some women to turn up instead of shoes but having a Ford Cortina on each foot, which no doubt caused tongues wagging because cars hadn't been invented yet. So there's a lot of explaining to do, really. This was not style. Of course it wasn't. If I turned up at the barbecue dressed like any of the things I've just said, I would be laughed out of the committee. But it was a reflection of social status and power, and that I do understand.
I've got a little bit of information about the day of the king, but I think we're coming up to time.
Well, I mean, I'm sure we can edit this.
Let's have a look then, shall I? So at 8:30, the first valet de chambre woke the king and said, "Sire, it's time to get up." And after a visit from the first doctor and the first surgeon, who'd squeeze his testicles and get him to cough, then the getting up ceremony began. And favoured members would enter the bedchamber to view the sovereign's member get washed, his pubic hair combed and his bottom shaved. And then the officers of the chambre and of the clothes storehouse entered for the grand getting up ceremony, which they would then dress the king and feed him his breakfast soup, which could be just Weetabix, I suppose, to be honest. And the number of spectators, all male, was probably over 100. Then at 10 a.m, the king led his procession of fawning buffoons through his hall of mirrors, while people tried to whisper in his ear or slip him a note, probably walking backwards, saying things like, "I think you're ace, and those shoes really make your eyes pop." And then he'd have a sit down to listen to his choir, which is a bit like listening to your iPod while you're, grinding your coffee, I suppose. Then at 11, he'd go back to his apartment and chat to all the different councils, like the King's Council, the High Council, the I'm not high, but I think I definitely feel weird council, and Mick Talbot and DC Lee's the Style Council. Then at 1 p.m, the King ate alone, looking out the window. I say alone, but most of the people who watched him get up in the morning were there too, just staring at him. Then at 2 p.m, he'd go for a walk or for a ride in his brioche, which is not a piece of bread, it's a four-seater carriage, with some ladies. And if he decided to go hunting, which was the favourite sport of the Bourbons, the monarch would go to the park to hunt down other biscuits, which is when jam biscuits first became known as jammy dodgers, as they were very difficult to find. Then at 6 p.m, the king's son would organise stuff for the courtiers to do while the king checked his emails. Then at, would you trust any of your sons to do anything for you? I mean, organise?
My eldest, I got him to relay tarmac on the drive, and he did a fantastic job. He passed out twice, but you know, that was the fumes. I mean, what can you do?
Well, and if you're only passing out on soft tarmac, it might be hot, but at least it's not hard.
No, exactly. So it broke his fall, absorbed the shock, and frankly, he just, you know, he was grateful for the opportunity because he got £15 off me. The youngest, I wouldn't trust him to boil an egg.
Then at 10 p.m, there's a dinner with silver service provided by the officers of the King's Mouth. Before then, he'd retire to his cabinet to converse more freely with his family and a few close friends. I don't know why they chose a cabinet, not a room, but, you know, nobody could question a Sun King, so they'd all just clamber into a bureau or something and have a chat. 11:30 p.m, going to bed ceremony, which is basically exactly the same as the getting up ceremony, where 100 men would just stare at him getting undressed. So Louis XIV, despite being God-given and made of sunlight, he died when he was 77 because blood stopped going to some bits of his body and those bits got gangrene.
That's not bad innings, though, is it?
Not bad for them, is it?
That lifestyle, imagine the food and drink he consumed. He lived to 77, my word.
Yeah, I wonder how many people watching him die. I don't think I'd appreciate that. It'd be bad enough, people watching me have my Weetabix in the morning. I don't appreciate them as I faded from the light.
I wonder if they were complimenting him as he died.
No, you know, that's very good drool coming out, isn't it?
Exactly. Oh, you've got nice eyes as they roll back into your skull.
Then he made his 5-year-old grandson his sequel, Louis XV, and he cucked it in his bed after 72 years as king.
And there we are. That's the end of him. And Versailles still stands. You can visit it if you really want. I mean, I always say, what's the point in having a royal palace if there's no royals actually living in it?
Personally, I think we should murder our own royals so that we could get in and have a look at their palaces as well. Wouldn't it be lovely? Apparently, they've got nice gardens. And, you know, I wouldn't mind having a little peek where Harry's had one of the wrist or something, you know, and look into
Hugh,
the same mirror as Charlie straightened his ears.
Hugh, that's bolshy talk and you know it. Rather left leanings notwithstanding, that was a fascinating delve into a particularly lesser known part of history that I think just proved to be absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah, me too, yeah.
But in a good way, you know? I hope you enjoyed that.
Yeah, I did, thanks, yeah.
And I hope you enjoyed it at home.
I did, yeah. Yeah.
And I hope... No, I'm talking to the... No, never mind. And we'll be back very soon with another episode of Allo, Histoire est ici. So remember, set your video, long play, not short play, so you can get more on your tape. And you'll get a nice reward of another episode very soon. So au revoir from me.
And it's a goodbye from me.
History for You with Douglas and Hugh was created, performed, written, produced by Adrian McKinder and James Devonshire, with music by Mike Jones. You can find us on social media. Of course, we're on X, formerly known as Twitter, at History4UPod. That's the number 4, the letter U. You can also find us on Facebook, which is a History for You podcast. Follow us, give us a like. Drop us a suggestion if you can think of anything you'd like to hear us cover. We're more than happy to oblige, as we've done in the past. Don't forget, there's a whole raft of back episodes to listen to wherever you get your podcasts. So check them out if you haven't done so already. And thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.